Hello and welcome back to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. On today's episode, I speak to language teacher and podcast host Isaac Myers. Isaac has a fascinating Mandarin learning backstory, which involves extensive travel around Taiwan and China and working at Google training language models for speech recognition systems. Through his podcast, Mandarin from the Ground Up, he teaches Chinese using the same imitation techniques we all use to learn our first language, all of which gives him a unique perspective and makes his insights on learning Chinese well worth listening to. So Isaac, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Misha.
So I wanted to start by asking you what I ask all my guests, which is, why did you first start learning Chinese?
I was about to graduate from college. I studied computer science, and I knew one thing was that I did not want to go directly into tech and just work at a desk job. And I realized this is the first time in my life when I actually get to make a choice where there's not really any limit. I mean, there's no given path. So what do I want to do? And the answer came right away. It was like this voice in my head, learn Chinese. That was it. It was like totally just an intuition.
So you had no prior experience of East Asian languages. You had no, why even learn a language?
I took French for one quarter in college over the summer, and I enjoyed it. I have some cousins in France, and I had the experience of being able to speak a little bit of French with them. And I thought, this is cool. Why Chinese? There was a scholarship or fellowship at the university that gave students $20,000 to travel around the world for a year with no strings attached. And I didn't get it. And I was really disappointed that I didn't get it. As part of the application, you're supposed to give them a plan of where you're going to go. And traveling around the world, I was going to go west. And the first place I was going to go was China. So I think that was part of it. I thought, okay, I didn't get the scholarship. I can do this anyway. I'll just work my way around the world.
So presumably you went to China. Yeah. Did you learn any Chinese before you got there? Or
I learned a bit. The first thing I did when I was still a few months from graduating was I started listening to Pimsleur. But in case some listeners aren't familiar with it, it's an audio, it's kind of an old school audio based approach. There's a guy who says, imagine you're an American sitting on a bus and you want to talk to the Chinese person next to you. How do you say, excuse me? And then there's a pause, and then you hear the 对不起, and then you repeat 对不起. So I started with that, and I had a few phrases under my belt by the time I went to China.
And then once you got to China, what was that like then? So did you have an experience of being able to use those phrases and be understood? What was that experience like?
Yeah, somehow I fumbled my way through living there. I had a lot of help. I went to Chengdu just because I had a classmate who was from there. And when I told her I'm going to China after I graduate, she said, go to Chengdu, it's great. And I said, okay. First, I went to Taiwan for 2 weeks. Then I went to Hong Kong and I bought a train ticket in Hong Kong to go to Chengdu, which is, like a 26-hour train ride. Because I rehearsed the lines, how do I buy the ticket and everything? And I said the things, and I didn't really understand fully what was going on. So it was only after I got my ticket that I realized, this train leaves right after the border from Hong Kong to Shenzhen opens, which means I actually have to spend the night in Shenzhen. And I don't know, I didn't have a hotel, I didn't have a smartphone then. So I just spent the night in a cafe in Shenzhen. My friend's dad met me at the train station and he put me up for 2 weeks and he helped me find an apartment. And he got the agent to be my friend. I had a lot of help getting set up there, which I would not have been able to. I did not have the tools to find a place to live and stuff like that at that point. I was there for 9 months-ish, and the main thing I did was I enrolled in Chinese classes at Sichuan University in the language program, which resulted in me speaking more English than Chinese. I made good friends from Germany, friends from Japan, friends from France, friends from Kenya, but our common language was English. The one thing that it did help me with was starting to learn characters, because at the time I hadn't really had much of an interest or motivation to learn the characters, and we had to memorize characters every day in that class. So it gave me a foundation for reading that did help later on. I assumed that the language center at Chuanda knew what they were talking about. It was on them now. It wasn't on me anymore. I paid the tuition. Now it was their job to make me speak Chinese. Now I think it's foolish to give up the responsibility for your own learning or anything important in your life to anyone else. But at the time that was kind of my excuse. And I thought living in China was the best immersion of all. Why would I have to keep studying?
So after that 9 months was over, what kind of level did you get to in Chinese?
I don't think I made that much progress. I was more comfortable with kind of very basic day-to-day, like ordering at a restaurant and stuff, because I was doing that on a daily basis to survive. Beyond that, I wasn't feeling like I was learning to speak. And, you know, I had to be honest with myself. I had spent all my money. My bank account was running low. I was not learning Chinese. It did not seem like I was going to make this round-the-world trip on my own steam. I honestly felt like I had failed when I moved back to the U.S.
At that point, did you think you'd continue learning Chinese or just give up?
I wasn't sure. I kept trying for a few months, but it felt like such an uphill battle because I think I had this voice that was like, I couldn't do it in China. What makes me think I can do it back here in the States?
Shortly after that, another chapter kind of emerged in your life, which was when you started working for Google.
So yeah, I started working. I got a job at a startup after I got back to the US. The startup, 6 months later, was acquired by Google, and that's how I wound up working at Google. And at the same time, I was getting ready to give up learning Chinese because I had just started a new job at Google and I was struggling enough with that just to keep up with all the work. But then one day my younger brother, he's 3 years younger, he called me up. He was in college at the time. He said, guess what, Isaac? I'm taking Chinese classes at university. And that did it. I was like, I cannot lose to my brother. I mean, it's so silly that that's where the motivation comes from. So I doubled down. And just around that time, a friend introduced me to this blog, All Japanese All the Time.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I know you're familiar with. In your book, you mentioned you're kind of like an all Chinese all the time guy, or at least were for a while. I was the same. I took that and I applied that to my life. So basically, it's this guy who he's living in the US and he treats himself as a Japanese person. He fills his home with only Japanese media. He talks to people only in Japanese. He's a Japanese person, you know. He's doing immersion of his own making. And so I tried to do kind of a watered down version of that. And another thing that really changed was how I thought about motivation. Because at the time I had thought, well, I'm just not working hard enough. And that's why I'm not learning Chinese. I mean, I was in China. How could I not learn Chinese in China? It must be my fault, right? I was a pretty good student in school. I tended to get good grades. I worked hard. I knew how to give the teachers, you know, what they expected of me. But one thing that I think I never really learned was how to learn when no one is on my back telling me what to do all the time. So it was a huge mindset shift for me to go from, oh, I just need to work harder. I just need to work harder. I'm not good enough, to no, actually, it's not that I'm not working hard enough. It's that I'm just doing things that aren't quite working. And maybe I need to find things that make it easier for me or more fun for me that will actually make me want to keep learning Chinese. And there was this moment, I remember I was like, you can do that? It could be fun to learn Chinese? Oh yeah. So first thing I did was I picked up comic books like manga that had been translated into Chinese. So something I enjoyed doing when I was younger and I'd kind of given it up and I thought, well, now's the perfect excuse to go back and do the things that I kind of felt like, oh, I like to do this, but it's a guilty pleasure kind of, because it's like, I don't feel like I have time because I have all this work to do, but it's for its good cause, so why not? So I also started to listen to Mandarin podcasts on repeat on my commute. I would watch Chinese TV. I started to put more of an emphasis on spending time with Mandarin speaking friends who, you know, began as conversation partners. I was very lucky to meet some who very quickly became friends. And so through this process, I started to live a sizable portion of my life, not all of it, but a portion of it in Mandarin. And that was really what started the snowball effect.
You referenced my experience there. And when I went through this period of being a kind of all Chinese, all the time disciple, I did notice that whereas all the things I'd done previously hadn't really worked, that I did improve in certain respects quite quickly, at least comparatively to before. I noticed that my comprehension skills were getting a lot better, a lot more quickly. Did you kind of also make similar jumps?
It felt like I started to improve a lot more quickly around that time. But it was almost like I had to trick myself into not thinking about it for it to happen. I found I had to find ways to make it so interesting that it was just something I did. Otherwise, I would be constantly thinking, am I getting better yet? Am I getting better yet? And then, you know.
How did you specifically go about doing that? Because I had that problem all the time when I was trying to immerse heavily in content. I was kind of constantly thinking about, like, am I getting better? And I think that did impact on, like, well, first of all, it's very frustrating because you're constantly trying to look for improvement. And even though it was faster than before, it's still gradual enough that if you're constantly looking for it, it causes frustration. I kind of struggled at a lower level to make it interesting enough and compelling enough that I didn't focus on that. how did you go about doing that?
Yes, you've actually named this is one of the big challenges of learning a language, especially early on. How do you make it interesting enough that you want to keep doing it when there's so much you don't understand? I think part of it was the mindset. It just happened to be that at that time in my life, I was not really happy with my job. I wanted to quit and go back to China. I wanted to keep traveling around the world. And I just felt like I'm stuck here at this job that I feel like I can't quit because it's such a great opportunity. Learning Chinese was a refuge. And I remember finding some podcasts where I had no idea what they were saying, but I listened to it again and again and again because I just liked the sounds of their voices. I just found it relaxing. And every time I listened to it, I would think, someday I'm going to live there. Someday I'm going to be able to speak like this.
So did you continue using, in combination with heavy input methods, did you also continue using listen and repeat? Did you practice saying the things you were listening to?
From the beginning, I think I've gotten a lot of satisfaction from being able to imitate the sounds. I get the same satisfaction from it that I get from singing. I just feel like it's cool. And I like the challenge of trying to do it as precisely as possible. That's one of the cool things about learning languages. Every language has got its own music. And trying to do that, it's like learning to sing another genre of music, you know?
So you had been working at Google for a couple of years during this period when you were continuing to learn Chinese in your spare time. So after a couple of years, you then transferred to a different department within Google that was more aligned with your interests and also your interest in language learning.
So my first 2 years I was working in ads, which I'm not too passionate about, but I switched to the speech team after a couple years, and I wound up working on training language models for all the different speech recognition systems in various languages. Actually, I enjoyed the work there a lot. I feel like I learned a fair bit about machine learning and also about language learning. I was listening to your interview with Ali Linga, and he mentioned that when we listen to something, we've got the top down and the bottom up. So bottom up is hearing precisely what phonemes are being said. You know, if I can hear clearly, then I can figure out what you're saying. And the top down is I've got a model of the language in my mind, and I can guess kind of as we're going along what type of thing you're probably saying. And these two things are complementary. So if I can't hear you very clearly, you know, if there's a lot of static or if you're shouting from somewhere far away, I can fill in the gaps using my top down. Conversely, if you're saying something that's a bit unusual, maybe with a lot of proper nouns or something, I need to have a much better bottom up. I need to be able to hear you very clearly to make sure I understand what you're saying. So it's interesting that the way speech recognition systems are trained roughly also relies on this insight. So the machine learning thing did drive home for me that it was possible to have a system that understands a language with basically a very dumb approach in a way, quote unquote, where it doesn't have any a priori understanding of the language itself. All it is data. I mean, everybody's familiar with this now because of ChatGPT, right? It's just a huge amount of data that you put into a neural network, train a neural network, and then, you know, give it a way of decoding the phonemes, the sounds that it's hearing, and coming up with hypotheses for how those fit into the model of the language that it creates based on this data. It kind of reinforced for me this idea that I don't need to understand grammar, for example, in order to learn how to speak this language, because our minds are not machine learning. Machine learning is based on the human mind, not the other way around, right? But that's what our minds do. We take this data and kind of interpolate it. And that's kind of the way I like to think about language learning. It confirmed for me that it should be possible to learn a language automatically, so to speak, kind of passively, just by getting lots of example sentences into my, quote, training set, which for me seems a lot more fun. I like the idea that my mind is kind of figuring out where the pieces go in this puzzle and inferring the grammar rather than having to take the top-down approach of being taught, like, this is how you conjugate this, this is how you conjugate this.
And this is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, which is sentence mining, which I think is a tremendously powerful tool and method.
I relied a lot on sentence mining as well. I prefer to use sentence mining of audio rather than text. For me, the ideal was something that has audio and a transcript, which oddly enough can be hard to find. For a while, I was listening to one called Slow Chinese. There was a Chinese pod where they had dialogues.
So then in 2015, you decided to move to Taiwan. So you left your job at Google and moved to Taiwan. So what was it that brought about that decision?
It was a number of things. Over the last previous few years, I had been spending more and more time talking with conversation partners slash friends who happened to be from Taiwan. So there was sort of this influence, and I found myself speaking more and more Taiwanese Mandarin. I had felt some kind of connection with the place when I first went in 2009 for 2 weeks. Something about the green of the mountains and the red of the buildings and the smell of the street and the alleys that had the vines and the ferns growing out of the windows. I don't know. It felt like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. Oddly enough, that kind of planted a seed, and I started to feel more and more like I was being pulled towards Taiwan. And oddly enough, quitting my job and moving there felt like moving home to a home I had never been to. It was like I had been cultivating an internal Taiwanese child, because I really think learning a language is a lot like growing a new child in your mind. And this child wanted to go home. He wanted to experience where his home was, where he could speak Mandarin with other people.
I believe in that first year, you set yourself a challenge to learn as many languages as possible.
Yeah, so I'm full of these harebrained ideas. When I was 20 and I was just starting to learn Mandarin, my plan was to learn 10 languages by the time I'm 30. That shows you what kind of crazy confidence I had at that point. And moving to Taiwan, I think I was 27. So I thought, oh, time's running out. Better get those other languages out of the way. But also I thought, if I try to learn a different language from zero every month for a year, I will probably learn something interesting about how to start learning a new language, which may help me in the future. And maybe I'll stumble on other languages that I actually really like. So I started with German, and I wound up sticking with German for a while. And actually, I tested out this approach of not learning any grammar. I've never read a textbook of German. I've never sat down and learned any of the grammar, but I speak with a certain fluency. I make a lot of mistakes still because I haven't really put in the time. Then I spent a month doing French, kind of reviewing French. And then I went on to Korean and then Farsi and a bunch of others. One thing I found is that my brain does have a capacity that cannot be exceeded. By the fourth or fifth month, something in me said, no, I cannot take another language. It's too much. I had been thinking I could keep them all going in parallel. That was the crazy thing. So pretty quickly, I concluded that the bottleneck was not how much time you can spend in a day, but how long. So I didn't get anywhere in a month of German. So I realized I needed to keep going while I was doing the French and the Korean and blah, blah, blah. So somehow or other, I had kind of five or six languages that I was working on every day, and it just got crazy. One of the things that was helpful during that year was I tried a lot of different websites, a lot of different apps, a lot of different methods. I made it my job to look up what all the different methods of learning languages were and try out each one. And I came up with things that I thought were helpful. And so by the end of the year, I had also met other language enthusiasts. There's actually a pretty good language learning community here in Taipei. I started going to an event called the Polyglot Cafe.
Is that the one that's led by
Terry? Yeah, Terry Xie is like a well-known polyglot here. Yeah, actually, he inspired me quite a bit. I went to one of his classes, and one thing he said stuck with me was this metaphor of the bicycle. You know, he asked, is language learning more like learning mathematics or more like learning to ride a bike? And the answer is, well, in school, it's taught more like mathematics. But actually, the way people learn to speak languages is a lot more like riding a bike. You can do it without knowing how you do it, and you learn to do it by doing it.
Also, once you reach a certain level, you never forget it.
Exactly. I was really gratified that when I moved to Taiwan, my Chinese was already pretty fluent. I could rent an apartment for myself. I could do all those things. And because of that, I was able to keep it improving because I was just living life in Chinese. So most of my life was spent in Mandarin. And I actually, for the first few years, I really made a point of avoiding getting in an English bubble like I had done in Chengdu. I made sure that, you know, not all of my friends were English-speaking foreigners. You know, I started going to a lot of events where I was the only foreigner. So at the time, my Mandarin was getting better, and I kind of just like living life in it. I did not really keep studying it, which if I had kept studying in the sense that if I had, say, kept reading books and watching movies in Mandarin a lot, my Mandarin would be better now. But it was good enough for me. I felt like I've reached my goal with Mandarin, more or less. I mean, I still have a long way to go, and I've improved a lot in the last 8 years of living in Taiwan, but I just wanted to be able to think of myself as a person, not necessarily a foreigner, but just a person living in Taiwan who speaks Mandarin. And there's nothing special about that. That was kind of the goal.
And all of these experiences eventually led you to moving towards a career of teaching the Chinese language. Once you'd reached a certain point in the language, your instinct was then to teach what you'd learned to other people.
Yes. This actually also started with my brother. I had a few conversations with him on Skype where I was trying out this method that I had an idea of, which was at that time, he still spoke very little Mandarin because he had actually only taken it for a semester. It was a false alarm. But it was fun being able to help him learn more just by speaking in Mandarin. I could use, you know, body language and, you know, pictures and context and help him get more and more fluent. We didn't do that for too long. And then when the pandemic started, another friend from the US who was planning to move to Taiwan, with her, I started to record practice audio dialogues for her to shadow. And after doing that for a few weeks, I thought, why not just make this into a podcast? I think this could be helpful for other people too. That's how I started my podcast, Mandarin from the Ground Up, which also forced me to think a lot about language learning from a different perspective.
And it's Language from the Ground Up is targeted primarily at sort of higher elementary or people who are towards the beginning of their Mandarin journey. Is that right?
Yeah. Mandarin from the Ground Up, the idea is to treat the listener like you're a newborn infant who is just starting to learn your native language, which is Mandarin. And of course, I don't pretend that this podcast or anything can single-handedly teach someone to speak a language. I don't believe that. I think you need to actually have interactions with people. And we can talk about when it's important to start actually speaking versus just listening, blah, 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 blah. It's fine. You know, babies babble for their first few years anyway. But I hope that in addition to helping people get a taste for what learning is like with Mandarin dialogues, I also try to give some advice in the podcast about how to go about doing that, how to find other resources, how to think of yourself as a Mandarin speaker before you actually can evidently speak Mandarin.
In your experience then of creating the podcast and teaching Mandarin, what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've faced in terms of helping people to learn Mandarin? What are some of the biggest obstacles, not only that they face, that you have faced in terms of trying to get them to overcome those obstacles?
I'll first admit that this is a tricky question for me because most of my Mandarin teaching experience has been making the podcast. And I get sometimes feedback from listeners, but it's not the same thing as being able to observe people in day-to-day learning environment. So I have to infer a lot or extrapolate from stuff that I hear. I'm spending more time teaching English because the environment I'm in, you know, there's a higher demand for that. But one thing I've observed is, I think you touched on this in your book too, actually. So you mentioned in your book that you became convinced at a certain point that adults don't actually have a harder time learning languages than children. And I believe that too. In fact, I think the opposite is true. Adults can learn languages more easily than children. So why is it, it seems to be from our experience, that adults have such a hard time learning language? I think one of the main reasons is because we already speak at least one language. So we already have a sense of who we are, because the way we speak a language is a big part of how we think about who we are. And so one of the obstacles I've observed in people who want to learn Mandarin but have a hard time doing it is that they don't seem quite willing or able to make room in their identity for a Mandarin-speaking part. I could make a conjecture that the biggest difference between people who do succeed in learning Mandarin and those who don't is the people who do actually actively want part of themselves to be a Mandarin speaker, that they have room for that. In fact, they're actively welcoming it, whereas other people, maybe there's a bit of resistance. Like when I was imitating Pimsleur way back when, I found it so cool. It's so cool that I can go up to my friend who's half Taiwanese and say something in Mandarin and make him laugh, because I sound so much like the Pimsleur tape. That was so cool. But then other people I see who kind of hesitate at that. Like they don't want to sound too much like it because they feel like that's not them.
That's a really interesting insight. I also had that a very similar experience to you. I remember I used to listen to a podcast. Well, I used to listen to various podcasts, and there was one in particular that was SBS Radio, which is the Mandarin speaking network on Australian radio. And there was this talk show host at the time who used to take calls from listeners, and he had this like kind of very standard Mandarin accent, but still with a slightly Beijing tinge. And it was absolutely beautiful. And it really bothered me that I sounded nothing like him.
Oh, this is interesting.
I really wanted to.
So you had this desire, and what did you do with that?
Well, initially I didn't really do very much with it except for more or less try to imitate the way he sounded. I still didn't really sound anything like him. Mm-hmm. Even to like my own ear, I didn't sound anything like him. I wasn't sure why, and I just kind of put it to the back of my mind until much later when I discovered that the main reason why was that I hadn't acquired tones.
Oh, right.
And then I went back, and that was a huge phase in my language learning, discovering the importance of tones, which I hadn't internalized at the beginning. Right. I'd kind of developed this atonal Mandarin could notice that there was some crucial difference between the way I was speaking and the way the people I was listening to were speaking, but couldn't pinpoint what it was. And I went through discovering tones and like actually focusing my mind on that and trying to imitate the pitch contours properly, right, and doing it more at natural speed and all that kind of thing. Then that was a really gratifying process that really aligns with what you've said earlier about language learning being similar to learning to sing
yes.
in a different language and learning the melody of that language.
I'm going to suggest that this is actually not something that's unique to learning Mandarin or tonal languages at all, because the same thing happens when my students are learning English. You mentioned matching the pitch contours, right? So, I mean, English has intonation. We have pitch contours too, and it is part of the meaning of what we're saying. And a lot of Mandarin speakers who learn English in school don't listen to that either. They're not taught about that. It's analogous, I would say, to the way a lot of English speakers or other foreigners learning Mandarin don't pay attention to tones. And actually, in a way, I don't know if you want to say it's more insidious, but because having the wrong intonation doesn't change the meaning of the words in English, it's not as noticeable maybe, but it can affect how understandable something is. Maybe not as much. You're not going to say a completely wrong thing, but it makes it a lot harder to understand.
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true. And in a way, I think that although tones have a bad reputation as being difficult to learn, and there's some truth to that, that they offer this kind of unrivaled key to open the door to being able to mimic the Chinese melody, because it's a system quite easy to understand rules. There's not very many of them. And once you've nailed them down, it gives you like a huge advantage in being able to copy the rhythm and melody of the language. Whereas where Chinese native speakers try and do that in English, they don't have kind of a very simple set of rules to follow.
That's a really good point. So in a way, you could say learning tones could be seen as being easier than learning intonation in non-tonal languages. Although I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. I've heard you talk about this in previous episodes, how to learn tones. I remember there was this idea of a stage approach where you first learn the official tones, but then at some point you also have to put them together and figure out how they flow into a full utterance where a lot of the tones don't quite sound the way that they're supposed to sound. I like to think about learning languages as, in the beginning, I'm just a parrot or an actor who's trying to play a role. I'm really trying to copy as exactly as possible the person I'm listening to. And, you know, the thought is, well, then do I lose myself? Do I not know who I am? But I think that after imitating enough different sources, you find your own voice.
In the beginning, if you immediately jump to mimicking and you don't kind of go through this phase of really nailing the individual tones and like tone pairs and this kind of thing, I do think that there are a large number of people who will imitate wrong and not know that they're imitating wrong.
Yes.
There's a video online of a guy who is a Spanish guy with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend keeps trying to teach him "Wo-mei-yo," and he keeps repeating "Wo-mei-yo." He can't hear the difference.
Yes. You have to have this back and forth. You imitate the thing, but then knowing that at this stage, my ears will not get every detail because I'm not there.
Right.
Right. I'm going to miss some things. And then you go back to the text or whatever, and you think, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. Did I hear that or not? And then you go and listen again. Oh, I didn't hear it that time. So, but it should be this. What's going on? Listen again. So this kind of constant going back and forth between the source, the audio, and the text can be a really powerful device. And sometimes you'll just get really confused. And I think that's when it's important to have a native speaker or somebody who can come in and say, oh, this is what you're doing. This is where you're getting lost. That's inevitable. To say it's just mimicking is an oversimplification. It's got to be a process of constantly trying to mimic, and also asking yourself, what am I missing here? Not getting complacent, assuming that every time I listen, I'm going to hear something different that I hadn't heard the last time.
In your experience of teaching, I think you said this to me before we started recording, that you had a student who I believe was learning English. You were talking about how T in English is pronounced in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes it's a glottal stop.
Besides, you know, the aspirated T, it can also be an unaspirated, you know, D, like for example, in stop. Or it can be a flap, you know, like bottle.
So it can be all these things.
Right.
And what your student wanted to know from you is, how on earth do I learn that? Do I just have to memorize all of the times it appears in different words and where and how it should be pronounced in each case? And this is a question that comes up for Mandarin, because people often ask, do I have to memorize the tone for every word?
Right.
And in my own case, I did end up doing that. Now, I think if you establish the muscle memory early on, for every word, and you just learn to say it the right way, so that like just saying it the wrong way just feels totally wrong, then it probably, the memorization aspect would play a lesser role. Is that kind of your feeling as well?
Yeah. So it's impressive that, first of all, to me, that you did it by memorization. Like, wow, that's dedication. Good for you. So coming back a little bit to this kind of machine learning metaphor, this idea of garbage in, garbage out type of thing. Like if what you're using to train your machine learning data doesn't include this flag, like every time I hear a word with the letter T in it, for example, I don't have to think about it, but I can hear the pronunciation of it. I can hear that it's a glottal stop. I don't even think about it because it's just part of my listening system and I can reproduce it. So I've got good data coming in, good data going out. And if I can't hear the difference, then I'm not going to be able to produce the difference. So I think that's the key. The first step is learning to, again, learning to distinguish the difference, which means training your ears to hear, for example, for in Mandarin, training your ears to be able to hear the tones reliably. So everything you hear that's coming in is giving you good data. If you ask a native speaker of Mandarin, what tone is such and such a word? They don't say, oh, it's tone 3. Right away, right? They say it aloud, or they'll think about it for a second. They hear it in their mind, and then they tell you, they translate that into the tone. So that's kind of what I say to people who are asking this question about the T sound, for example, which is once you've got good data coming in, then you're starting to build up a bank of experience, auditory memory. And then if you don't know the sound, you could just ask yourself, well, what does it sound like in my head? What did I hear? What have I heard most people say?
I totally agree with that. And one thing I want to add just in my own experience was that like the role that memorization played was largely connected to the date, what you're talking about with data. It was to make sure that the data was coming in correctly. So if I memorized that, I don't know, ni hao was like 3-3, the next time I heard it, I would notice that. And
right.
then, so that meant the data was coming in correctly and then I could rely on that.
Right.
Because it would sound wrong when I said it wrong.
I totally follow you. I mean, actually, this perfectly fits the machine learning metaphor because, you know, there are times when the data you have is bad and you actually have to hire people to go in and manually label or correct the data before you feed it back into the machine. It sounds like that's kind of analogous to what you were doing.
Brilliant. That's been truly fascinating to discuss all your experiences learning Chinese, teaching Chinese, and I'm sure there's loads all our listeners will take away from that. So once again, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Misha. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.